This is Justin with a quick note before today's show. I know that some of you are traveling frequently on deployments with limited connectivity, so I've put together a deployment kit. It's a flash drive with 80 episodes, including ones I haven't yet released on the show, as well as ebooks and a PDF of all the show notes. Check it out on the resources tab at beyondtheuniform.io. Thanks and enjoy the show. Welcome back to Beyond the Uniform. I'm Justin Assiri, and each week I interview military veterans about their civilian career. Today is episode number 65 with Mark Frank.
He's like, look, this is really where you see what you're made of, yeah. Right? This is where either you fold up and die, or you push through and figure shit out and make it happen. Mm. And so luckily I was able to like keep working through it, keep pushing things forward incrementally, and then recognize that there were some strategic things that we needed to do to fix that. That's what created Next Oncology, which was like transitioned to a $3 million a year, you know, revenue business to more of like a $7-8 million a year business.
The top two reasons to listen to today's interview are, number one, originality. Mark took a relatively non-traditional route to entrepreneurship. He first went into finance at Morgan Stanley before starting his first company. He talks about how this path helped him on his entrepreneurial journey. Number two, serial entrepreneurship. Mark has started four companies and sold two of them. He's got tons of great advice on how to go about starting and growing your company. As always, at beyondtheuniform.io, you'll find other shows as well as show notes for this episode, where you'll find links to everything we discussed and timestamps so you can skip around if you'd like. And with that, let's dive in to my interview with Mark. So today I'm at the Sondermind headquarters in Denver with my guest today, their CEO and founder, Mark Frank. Mark, welcome to Beyond the Uniform.
Thank you.
So for listeners, quick background on Mark. He's the CEO and co-founder of Sondermind, a startup that is focused on making mental health services more accessible and accepted for everyone. He started out at West Point and served as an infantry officer in the Army for 5 years. After the Army, Mark earned his both his MBA and Master's of Engineering Management at Northwestern University. After grad school, he was an associate investment banker at Morgan Stanley for 2 years before serving as founder and CEO at Next Oncology. After 6 years at Next Oncology, he sold the company in a deal that brought a 12x return to investors. Since then, in addition to founding Sondermind, Mark has also started Safe Image MD and Term Scout, as well as served as the managing director of the investment company Goldwing Capital. So I guess first, anything to add or amend on that intro?
So one is I served in the infantry division. I was a logistics officer. Mm. So I don't want to get anybody up in arms on that. And then the path that I took with Next Oncology and Safe Image and those other things was interesting in that Safe Image actually founded in the middle of Next Oncology with my current CTO, Sid, who's our CTO from Safe Image or from Sondermind right now, and a former employee who was our medical physicist.
Great.
So that was, I have a little bit of like professional ADD, I guess. Yeah. And so I've always had to sort of work around different things.
That's great, though. I imagine that keeps the creative juices flowing when you're able to use your brain in different ways.
Yeah, it totally does.
Yeah. So I always like to start by asking at what point you knew you were going to leave the Army and how you approached that decision.
Yeah, so I graduated in 2000, so I was part of the Corps that didn't come in knowing that we were going to be deployed, right? Mm. And graduated not knowing, we graduated in sort of this peacetime, so 96 to 2000. One of the reasons I became a logistics officer was like, well, I might as well learn a skill. There's nothing else really going on. And so that said, when I went in, I was like, I'm pretty sure I'm not going to stay in beyond my 5-year commitment. Interestingly, I became a little more interested in staying in longer, a few years into the Army, particularly after 9/11 and after things started kind of heating up. Not that I'm like wanting to go be deployed, but the nail in the coffin of my time in the Army was really getting married, and then this was pre-OIF, and then being deployed 6 months after with OIF-1 with 4th Infantry Division for a year. So our first, about 6 months after we were married, I was gone for a year.
And
we didn't have kids or anything like that, so it was a little easier than for a lot of our peers, but my wife was like, do you really, really, really want to be in the Army? And I didn't really, really, really want to be in the Army, and so it was time for me to go.
That's great.
Yeah.
What was the thought process of going straight to school versus into industry?
Yeah, I thought a lot about it. So we were talking a little bit earlier. I got my real estate license when I came back from Iraq, mainly because I didn't want to pay somebody to sell my house. I had a master's degree already. I took tuition assistance. This was kind of pretty quickly there after taking over my first platoon. Conjunctively, you can take tuition assistance and not have it add to your time as long as the time when you end doesn't increase your commitment time.
That's great.
So I got a Master of Science in Computer Information Systems part-time from the University of Phoenix during that time.
Okay.
So, I had this interest in sort of computers. My undergrad was in computer science. Had logistics experience from my Army time. Had real estate experience, having done a few deals on the side. And this is back in 04, 05 time frame when, real estate's super, super hot. And, I talked to the normal sort of cadre of, Cameron Brooks and Bradley Group or whatever it was called.
These different.
And, they want you to... They want somebody to put into the factory, right? They want to, take you, put you in a bunch of interviews, send you to one of those career conferences, and then put you in the company. They don't want somebody who's got multiple options.
Yeah.
I want to explore lots of things because that's just more time and cost to them.
Yeah.
So, interestingly, they kind of steered me away. I had thrown my hat in the ring for a lot of business schools. Not a lot, but, I applied to 6 different business schools, took the GMAT, and was like, all right, if I get into one of the top business schools, then I'll go, right? It was like, I already have a master's, so I'm not going to go check the box at getting an MBA just from any school. Mm-hmm. I really thought that the value came from the network and from kind of the stamp on the resume.
Totally.
So ultimately, as I, got into some business schools, I talked to a lot of grads, a lot of veterans who had gone to business school, learned more about the opportunities that they had coming out of business school as opposed to the ones that I was looking at, just coming straight out of the Army. It was pretty clear of I should go. Northwestern made it easy for me by saying, hey, that dual degree program that I was a part of, I didn't apply to originally. They actually said, hey, because you're undergrad and because you have this master's in a hard science type thing, this is a perfect fit for you. And oh, by the way, we'll give you a grant that covers 65% of your tuition costs. This was before the post-9/11 GI Bill. So, they made it kind of easy for me.
What was that like? Did you do both of those in 2 years?
Yeah, so the way it's structured at Northwestern is this dual degree program. You have the MBA, which is part of the Kellogg School of Management.
Yep.
And then a subset of the Kellogg students, or 55 of us, have another section. So you have your section with the rest of your business school classmates.
Yep.
And then you have a section that's just the Triple M students, which is this program. And you just basically take more classes. Some that are in the engineering school, and there's just prerequisites that you have to hit beforehand, and they make you go into turbo finance because they figure you can do math and that kind of stuff. So there's actually a fair number of academy grads. I mean, of the 55 of us who were in that program, I had 450 something classmates at Kellogg, so 390 were not part of the Triple M program.
Mm-hmm.
Of the 55 that were, I think there were 6 or 7 other academy grads.
Oh man, that's pretty high.
And maybe 2 other other military. I mean, it's pretty interesting when you figure we had 7-8% military at Kellogg.
Yeah.
But closer to 15%, 16% in this Triple M program.
Wow. Would you recommend that path? I mean, was it too overwhelming to try and do both of those simultaneously?
Not for me, but I also was married.
You like to be busy.
Yeah, I like to be busy. I mean, I've got a little bit of a workaholic thing going, hopefully not too much. I like to have fun too. But, I was married, and it's one of the reasons I chose Kellogg over some of the other schools I applied to.
Yeah.
Because they have a really high contingent of married students. So I think it's for at least when I went there, it was 30 or 40% were married. Versus another school Wharton I was considering was 15% married.
Okay.
So just the culture is very different. You can just imagine, right? If you have only 1 or 2 out of 10 of your classmates are also married and none have kids versus every other one is married.
Yeah.
The social scene is different. How you interact with them.
Yeah.
You know, how your spouse is involved with the, you know, with the school environment. It affects everything. So for me, it wasn't a big deal because I wasn't going out and partying every single night. And Kellogg is a little bit of a, as far as the business schools go, it's on the party end, which is one of the reasons I chose it too, right?
I loved Kellogg. I visited there and I thought it was the closest of every business school I went to Stanford, and that like everyone just loved being there.
Yeah.
Everyone was like very grateful to be there. And I think similarly, because it's a very small class size, everyone just kind of got to know each other, and it felt very family-like, which I like that.
Yeah, they're really, really focused on the team, the team environment.
So after after business school and grad school, what led you to Morgan Stanley?
So that's interesting. So I, you know, in this sort of discussion around choosing business schools and whether to go or not, I came to the conclusion that I wanted to do consulting, management consulting. So again, another reason why I didn't choose more finance school like Wharton or MIT.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, I don't want to do banking. I read Monkey Business. That seems like a horrible industry to go into. The few people that I spoke with who had dumped banking were like, oh, it's really like a bad lifestyle and all this sort of stuff. So I said, I'm going to do consulting. That's why I'll go to Kellogg. It's like all these McKinsey and Bain and everything there. So before I started business school, when I got out of the Army, you know, my wife and I traveled for a little bit during terminal leave, and she was finishing her nurse practitioner master's degree, was working downtown as a nurse for the summer before business school.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm like, I'm not going to sit around on my butt all summer. so I lined up my own internship before business school even started, actually with another West Point grad. He was like class of 70. HBS 74, had done management consulting for 30 years, had written a couple books on like M&A integration, and moved into what I thought was another kind of consulting company. Is like he was recently a CEO. At the time he was heading North America, and you know, I thought, okay, I'm going to work directly with this guy for the summer. I'll learn a lot about consulting. It'll be good, and I'll learn business stuff. Well, lo and behold, it's an M&A advisory shop. And, you know, at the end of the summer, I really liked the work I was doing. More importantly, here's a guy who had hired hundreds, if not thousands, of consultants over his career. He was like, I think you'll do well at it, but I think you'll hate it. He's like, you're an operator. You're an execution guy.
Yep.
You know, he's like, I just think you're just really going to be unhappy doing the consulting thing.
Do you think he was right?
I think he was right, yeah. And I actually, I mean, I went to a number of the, you know, like, sessions and the pitch things and all that sort of stuff, and I ultimately was like, yeah, I really want to be traveling all the time and you know, going to a different client every like 4 to 6 months and never really getting into the details and come up with some great strategic plan and handing it off and never seeing if it actually gets implemented, when 9 times out of 10 it doesn't get implemented. That coupled with the fact that because of this dual degree program that I was in, as I mentioned, they force everybody into this turbo finance, which was basically finance one and finance two, which are usually two separate classes in different quarters, into one course. Same content.
Yeah.
And what I found was I really liked the finance stuff.
Yeah.
And I had done, and I had always liked, I mean, I started investing in the equities market when I was a cadet, you know.
Yeah.
And so I've always liked personal finance, stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
Really liked the corporate finance stuff more so than kind of the marketing side of things in general. So I was like, well, what do I want to, you know, it's all like on a timeline when you're in full-time business school, right? Like you have your thing, you like focus on what you're going to do for your internship. And I felt like, all right, I'll do some finance focused things for my internship, threw my name in the ring for all the investment banks. And this was in, you know, fall of 05. So very few of us were out of the Army or out of the military and had been deployed and were in business school.
Yeah.
Right. Like now, every veteran who's in business school has been deployed at least once, right? But I was kind of a novelty. And I was a novelty in that, you know, I was the only veteran from Kellogg who was applying to business school or applying to investment banks for the summer. So I think I got a bunch of closed interviews just because of the fact that I had, you know, a year in Iraq on my resume.
Yeah.
And people just want to hear stories.
Yeah.
And ultimately they're like, oh, we'll give this guy a shot. So then, like, the thought process was like, oh, I'm not going to do banking full time, but I might as well do it for the summer.
Yeah.
And you know, see how it goes, and at least I'll see if I like finance or not. That'll be kind of like the boot camp for finance for, you know, 10 weeks.
Yeah.
And what I found was I really liked the work.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, yeah, it's a lot of work. I mean, you're working like literally 90 to 110 hours every single week, right?
And it's brutal.
It's not like there's a spike that's 100 hours or something. It's like, that's the norm, right? It's maybe once every 4 or 5 months you get like a drop down to 75 hours, something like that.
How did your, I'm just curious, because you had said that, you know, one of the driving reasons for getting out of the military with your spouse was the time away.
Yeah.
How did she respond? Did it feel to her the same as when you were deployed, or was it different because you were at home at least, you know, at nights and stuff?
Yeah, so very different, and that's a good question. I mean, it's one of the reasons why we talked a lot about, like, consulting or banking or these other things, and, you know, she's like, well, in consulting, you're gone.
Yeah.
Right? Like, you're leaving Sunday night, you're back Thursday night.
Yeah.
And I don't see you, maybe I talk to you on the phone or something like that. At least in banking, you're home.
Yeah.
You can kiss your kid goodnight. Maybe not goodnight, he's already sleeping.
Yeah.
But you can be home. You're around the corner. You're not traveling. I mean, maybe if you're traveling, it's like day trips. You're going gone in the morning, come back at night.
Yeah.
From her perspective, I mean, we were only, so this was like, you know, I did my internship in 06, summer of 06. I was in Iraq in the summer of 03, right? So 03 to 04.
Yep.
So we're only 3 years removed. And it was OAF1 where there was like no communication.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, like there was no email until 9 months in. And even then it was like I could get on army.mil or whatever it was and like email once every 2 weeks. So from her perspective, she was like, I know you're not getting shot at. I know there's no mortars. I don't have to like watch the news and see what happened. I don't have to like wait for the phone to ring and like, you know, the civil affairs or the spouse assistance officers coming to the door. So she didn't have any issue with it.
Yeah.
It was more for me, like, especially once we had our first kid, where I was like, this can't last forever.
And given, you know, given your history in startups after Morgan Stanley, I'm wondering, how do you look at that? Are you grateful that you did that? Or do you feel like, had you known from the start you were going to go into startups, you wish you would just dove right in?
I wish I could answer that question.
Yeah.
I mean, I grapple with it. I like think back in my mind, something to grapple with. It's like past, you know. But I definitely think like, well, there's definitely for the first company. So Denver Cyberknife, which turned into Next Oncology.
Yeah.
My experience in banking was very, very helpful.
Yeah.
We financed the company with, you know, over $5.5 million of debt that was personally guaranteed. You know, I started with before employees, before marketing, before anything, I had a $200,000 a month nut to crack.
Wow. Right?
So, like, managing working capital was job number one for me. I mean, hiring and all the other stuff and building a brand and everything else. But, like, from a financial standpoint, we started the company with, like, 4 months runway. And it wasn't like, oh, if this goes bad, just shut the doors and sorry, employees, like, you're going to have to find new work.
Yeah.
It was like, if this goes bad, we'll shut the doors, say, sorry, employees, got to find new work. And then we got to, like, I got to file for personal bankruptcy and, you know, I mean, this big equipment and we bought this real estate and all this other stuff, right?
Yeah.
So for me, it was really helpful. I knew, I mean, I did healthcare investment banking and M&A and things like that. So I knew enough about healthcare to think I knew something about it.
Yeah.
The reality is healthcare is so different than, like, any industry and there's so much complexity to it that there was a huge learning curve. But thinking back on like what I'm doing now, or thinking like about Term Scout, which is still operating, just raised their Series A. But you know, data, you know, it's a data company, sales intelligence, pure software tech company. That's where it's like if I was going to go down that path, then my experience in banking isn't all that helpful.
Yeah,
and I would have been better served. Definitely, like, going and getting experience in a technology company.
Yeah.
And probably better serve from a career standpoint and going to get, you know, the Google stamp on the resume instead of the Morgan Stanley stamp.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep. Yeah, it's interesting because I was supposed to go and work in consulting and then ended up starting the company and told them, you know, reneged on my offer, essentially. Mm-hmm. And I kind of have a similar debate, too, which is like, hey, gained a lot of operational experience, which I think is great because you learn so much on the ground.
Yeah.
And I kind of like looked through this lens of I could have learned a lot of valuable skills in consulting too. And you never really know what the other path would have looked like.
Right.
But it's just kind of interesting seeing that, you know, being able to hone a skill before starting a company versus diving in.
Yeah.
What was the genesis of Next Oncology then? Was that while you were at Morgan Stanley, like working in this industry, and you saw the opportunity?
So, no. So, Next Oncology, and I mentioned earlier, so Denver CyberKnife was the original company that we started. So, I realized about a little over a year in, mm-hmm. that while I really liked the work of an associate, mm-hmm. maybe I've got some weird, like I said, workaholics.
Said no one in the history of the world. Right. Yeah.
No, I mean, it's very analytical, and like you really run the show in terms of like the deal itself. At least in Morgan Stanley in Chicago, right? Like every group, every bank is different.
Yeah.
Our VPs, we didn't have that many, so and we did full execution M&A. So for example, I worked on the Cardinal Health spinoff of CareFusion.
Yeah.
Big deal, $7 billion spin. Mm. I mean, the deal team was at the time Michael Boblick, who I think he might be like president of, he was the head of M&A for Morgan Stanley. Sandy Thompson, who was the head of the healthcare group and the head of Chicago office, a VP of M&A in New York, mm. myself and an analyst in Chicago. Mm. And so pretty small deal team for a big
for thing. A lot of money, yeah.
Yeah, for a lot of money. And the M&A VP, he was running like a bunch of other things. And I was running a couple other things too, but they were smaller. Mm. So I liked that. I mean, I was like interfacing with, you know, the CFO of Cardinal Health and like, you know, dealing with stuff and helping their controller like think through their projections and all that sort of stuff. So it was very engaging work. And as I looked forward to see like, well, what is the MD doing? What's the managing director doing across, you know, all the groups, not just on this deal? They're selling, right? Yeah. Like that's their job. It's like, hey, hire Morgan Stanley, not Goldman Sachs.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep. Same with consulting.
It's the like, same with consulting, right? Yeah. So I was like, is that where I want to go? Right? Like kind of like what I'm doing now. I had been fortunate to make it through a lot of cuts. And so when I started, there were 8 associates in the Chicago office. When I left, there were 3 of us left.
Wow.
And so the path for me to continue to get promoted was pretty clear.
Yeah.
And I was told that. They were like, you know, I did well, bonuses and all that sort of stuff. And so I was like, all right, well, here I am. In a year, I'll be a VP. And then I'll be like, well, I'm going to stick around for like at least my first VP bonus. And then it'll be like a lot of money. And I'll be like, well, I might as well get the next one. And then I'm only like, I'm going to make ED, right? And I'm relatively personable. I mean, there's some associates and VPs who are like purely like finance guys. And they just can't really sell.
Yeah.
It's why the banks like to hire veterans.
Yeah.
Because we know how to talk to people and like be not just analytical, right?
Yeah.
And so I just saw these golden handcuffs like getting taken off the shelf and starting to get put on one wrist and then the other. And I was like, I won't be able to get out rationally in like I basically have a year or two window.
Yeah.
So I started looking. I didn't want to go to like a corp dev role where private equity wasn't hiring. This is fall of 08, right? So like the normal sort of like two paths are going to corp dev or going to private equity. Well, private equity shops were closing all day long and they weren't doing any deals. They weren't, banks were firing everybody, a lot of talent on the street. So that door was closed. Mm-hmm. So like, let me look for something that's just unique. So I started networking. So I got in touch with this guy, 86 West Point grad, became a neurosurgeon, started a number of companies, multiple significant exits. And he's like a founder chairman guy. He's never been
CEO. How did you find him? Like, how did it?
Just like talk to people.
Yeah.
To, you know, it's just like everything, networking, kind of talk to people.
Yeah.
So he had this idea. He had started a company. He had started one of the first free hospital-based CyberKnife centers in the country that was non-academic. It was like CyberKnife Center number 6.
Mm.
They have like 350 now. And so, you know, he kind of told me his idea, which was start a freestanding radio surgery center that's not affiliated with a hospital where we run the show completely. And he was like, I'll be the investor. He's like, I've talked to some docs who might be interested, and there's one I'm particularly interested in kind of bringing on.
Wow.
But like, you would run it. You'd be like, you would like start everything. And so I remember,
it's like the dream, man.
Yeah, it kind of was.
Cause like, there's so many people, right, that say like, I want to start something, but I don't know what.
I don't know
and this
what.
Is like the mythical person who comes along and says, right. This is what, and I'm going to support you.
Yeah, exactly. Incredible. Right.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we met a few times. I remember flying out to Boulder, and it didn't really hit me until, like, he's a very much like gut feeling kind of guy. Mm-hmm. So he basically, like, I thought we were going to have a day long interview kind of thing.
Yeah.
And we did, but it wasn't, I thought it was going to be like interview, and it wasn't. It was just like, he wanted to make sure, you know, in his own words, he's like, I wanted to make sure you weren't a fucking idiot.
Yeah. yeah.
And so it was like, you know, a lot of people can con you on the phone. And stuff. Yeah. It's hard to do that face to face.
Yeah.
So I remember, like, we met up in Boulder. We were driving down to, like, the site he was thinking about opening the location, and he's in the car, and he's like, so what do you think? You want to take this thing? We had, like, talked. We hadn't talked anything.
Yeah.
Like, pay, yeah. anything, right? And I'm like, what? And so, you know, I started asking him, like, well, what's sort of the benefits package like? At this point, I had, you know, how old was Ethan? Ethan was a little over a year. You know, I'm still at Morgan Stanley, and they've got great benefits, and I'm in a good spot, and I just got my bonus and all this stuff. And so, you know, he's like, no, I don't think you understand. He's like, you'll have a tax ID number, we're going to set up a bank account, and you'll go, right? Like, if you want to start a benefits plan, start a benefits plan. You're going to have to, like, set everything up. You got to hire everybody. You got to finish up the real estate build. You got to do everything. It's all you to, like, do this. Negotiate with insurance companies, all that stuff, right? That's all. You're going to do everything.
Yeah.
So I was like, whoa, okay. And, you know, from my standpoint, here I was like, all right, worst case scenario, the thing goes bust, right? I file for bankruptcy because I put money in. And I also, like, signed these debt guarantees, which was way above and beyond my personal net worth at that point.
yeah.
And I was like, but worst case, you know, file personal bankruptcy. And, you know, likely if that happens, it'll happen in, like, the first 3 years. And I can go back into banking at, like, a mid-market bank, or I can go work for a hospital, or I'll have, like, banking healthcare experience. I've got a good MBA. You know, I'll have operational healthcare experience. So I'll have enough of a sort of track record to go have a very soft landing from a career standpoint. But the upside was I get to learn if I'm any good at being an entrepreneur, if I like it, right? If there, you know, there's obviously, like, financial upside that was tied to it. So it was just, like, one of these happenstance things that,
you know, I mean, I think you're very humble about it. That's still a lot of risk, especially, you know, one of my fears in going to consulting was I would get comfortable with an extravagant lifestyle and I might never, and get so sensitive to risk that I would never jump off again. And who knows if that's true. But I'm just putting myself in your shoes at Morgan Stanley, lots of money, huge bonus, clear career path, you know the land, and then to jump off and take that, still a pretty big, you know, that's still diving in head first. That's incredible.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I guess I just, I think back to, like, my business school essays.
Yeah.
Right? And yeah. I remember, like, you went through the process,
yeah.
right? So, like,
yeah.
It's like they ask you 5 or 6 questions or whatever, like, different 5 or 6 different essays that they write. And I feel like it was all, like, variants of the same questions,
yeah.
you know, across schools.
Yeah.
So one of the essays, I can't remember what it was or what the – I just remember, like, the theme around it.
Yeah.
Around this one essay there, it was, like, no regrets, mm-hmm. right? It was, like, living my life such that, you know, when I look back, when I'm 60, 70, 80, 90, whenever I'm on my deathbed, that I'm not like, man, I had an opportunity, go do that, and I really wanted to, but I didn't because – I was risk averse,
yeah,
or whatever the reasoning was, right?
Yeah.
Now there's always going to be some level of, like, what ifs, right?
Yeah,
like we just talked about.
Yeah,
but I felt like, to your point, I would become more risk averse as I got further entrenched. I talked about the golden handcuff thing. I mean, that was where I was like, I very explicitly thought to myself, if I don't do this now, I probably won't do it ever.
Yeah,
and I mean, my goal for going into banking in the first place was I'll do this for 10, 15 years. I thought I'd really like the whole experience.
Yeah.
And then, you know, at 15-year point or whatever, I'll have $10, $20 million at the bank.
Yeah.
And I'll go find a business school classmate who's been operating at Danaher and has been GM for the last 5 years. And I'll go, hey, let's go find a company to go buy.
Yeah.
And I'll have a nice cushion and everything. But the goal was always run a company.
Yeah.
Right? That was always the end goal.
Yeah.
And as I thought about it, I was like, well, if I don't want to be a salesperson, if I don't like what the career is going to be for the next 10 years, and it's not explicitly doing what I want to end up doing,
yeah.
I'm not learning to run companies by being a banker.
Yeah.
I should start doing what I want to do now.
Yeah.
Even if it's lower on, you know, even if the risk reward profile isn't as good as where I'm at.
Yeah.
You know, it's, you only live life once.
Yeah. Right?
So,
what was the worst moment at Next Oncology, and what did you learn from that?
So I founded the company, it was like April 1st, 2009, mm-hmm. right? By that meaning, that's when, like, we set up, like, payroll started, yeah. right? For like, yeah. myself and like, the first people I employed.
Yeah.
I think it was in, like, February, March 2010.
Yeah, oh, man.
Now, like, basically, the prior 6 months, mm-hmm. we had been literally, like...
yeah.
Like every month it's like, all right, hopefully, you know, that we can like reduce our AR days by, you know, 20 or 15 days, or whatever, or like extend the line of credit with the bank to like, so we can make payroll, like keep this thing going. So it was like that stress.
How many people were there at the time?
11 employees.
Oh man. So you got 11 people depending on you to yeah. see a paycheck at their bank yep. account. Yep.
And so, you know, we hit kind of February and I remember talking to Jeff and being like, how do you deal with, like in your past things, how have you dealt with the stress of not knowing if this thing's going to succeed?
Yeah.
And having, you know, people's like livelihoods being, you know, your responsibility. It's a different stress. I mean, it's similar to being an officer in the military,
yeah.
right? Or an NCO or whatever, but like it's different because in that sense, like you need to train your soldiers. You need to make sure that they're well prepared. But at the end of the day, there's somebody trying to shoot you, mm-hmm. right? And you just, you can only do so much, right? Yeah. But you're never really responsible for, hey, are they going to get paid?
Yeah.
Right? Like, are they going to be able to feed their family?
Yeah.
Right? So you don't have that piece of it. It's more of, like, actual professional job risk.
Yeah.
So to a certain degree, I felt like it wasn't as high a level of responsibility as what I felt, maybe it's just me,
yeah.
what I felt for my employees and being like, I got to keep this thing going. And it was just like this wall where I remember thinking, what did I do? Right? Like, why did I leave this cush
yeah.
job where I worked a lot, but I'm working just as much now. I'm making, you know, a third of what I made before.
Yeah.
And, you know, there wasn't really anything, like, the upside wasn't even in sight. It was just like, can we salvage this thing?
Yeah.
And, you know, a couple of months after that, you know, he was like, look, this is really where... You see what you're made of,
yeah.
right? Like, this is where either you fold up and die, or you, like, push through and figure shit out and, like, make it happen.
Mm.
And so, luckily, I was able to, like, keep working through it and, like, keep pushing things forward incrementally. And then, you know, by this point, like, a year and a half in, I had recognized the flaws in the business model and recognized that there were some strategic things that we needed to do to fix that and to really turn this from being like, hey, this is going to be an okay business to being like a really good business,
mm-hmm.
and was able to structure one failed deal. It failed for a variety of reasons, but it was good that it failed. And then another deal that ended up being really successful with a physician group. And that's what created Next Oncology, which was like transitioned Denver CyberKnife and really turned like, you know, kind of a $3 million a year, you know, revenue business with kind of a $200,000 to $300,000 a year EBITDA to more of like a $7-8 million a year business with like $3.5-4 million EBITDA,
mm-hmm.
Because of this like deal structure. And just back to your earlier question about like
yeah.
the banking experience, that yeah. was extremely helpful, right? I mean, like I had now been on like the sell side and the buy side and an advisor, and then I went through a sales process and ended up saying no, but after a 9-month process with HCA, who wanted to buy the company, and then that led into doing this deal, which was a very unique structure that we created, and it turned out really well for everybody. So.
What was your proudest moment?
My proudest moment was probably 3 months in or 2 months in when we treated our first patient.
Mm.
Right, because that's when it was real, right?
Yeah.
Like everything up to that point was like, all right, we're marketing. The doctor we partnered with, we actually brought him in from out of state. So he was building his own. When we were helping him build his own practice, I mean, I was like basically marketing for him too to like build his practice
yeah.
as a radiation oncologist. He brought no referrals with him, no relationships whatsoever, which is a killer when you're talking about like surgeons or oncologists or things like that. I mean, they live and die by referrals from other physicians.
Yeah.
Just treating that first patient, and it was a great outcome. Mm-hmm. And then I think like the next proudest piece was, you know, we really became the leading center for CyberKnife for prostate cancer in the world.
Wow.
You know, I mean, after about 3 years, we battled pretty hard against Medicare. They had some different rules for this region on how prostate cancer CyberKnife treatment was reimbursed. Basically, they were denying everything. Hmm. We fought all these denials. We brought like 184 claims to administrative law judge review, won every single one of them, which was, I mean, it was like a 24-month process. This is like, and it was, you know, lots, hundreds of thousands, many hundreds of thousands of dollars in payments that we never got paid until we won all those, right? So we're floating that for a long period of time.
Oh, man.
And my manager of operations, who now at Sondermind, who is my billing manager and office manager after the fact at Denver CyberKnife, then became Next Oncology and Nova Cancer Care, she's working with me now as our, she manages all of our payer network stuff.
So, that's pretty rad.
She's awesome, yeah.
I'm wondering, what was the acquisition process like? What did you learn through that?
So that was interesting because it was a, you know, we sold to the physician group that we partnered with. So I actually went through a process shortly after we created Next Oncology. So I created Next Oncology in conjunction with this deal with this physician group in 2012. So 2009, 2012 was Denver CyberKnife. Next Oncology was formed in 2012 in conjunction with this deal. About 9 months later, we had a couple of inquiries from some private equity firms, and they wanted to buy Next Oncology. Ended up saying no because they just weren't giving credit for what I knew was going to be really strong cash flow.
Yeah.
And from our standpoint...
Which is, again, where your finance background probably comes
from. Yeah, I mean, I could do all... I mean, that's their background, too, but they're used to taking advantage of, like, somebody who can't really do that math.
Yeah.
I mean, not that it's hard math, but you know what I mean. Like, kind of has the experience in going through it.
Yeah.
And actually still good relationships with both of those potential acquirers. Mm. Fast forward a couple of years, and I had looked, more than looked into it, actually hired a business development guy who was out of state, who really knew this space. We, you know, shook a lot of trees, kicked a lot of tires, whatever you want to call it, at potentially expanding the model, opening some other locations in Manhattan, in Houston, in El Paso, in some other spots. And I knew enough at this point operationally that what to look for, what's the right market environment. Healthcare is always local.
Yeah.
And particularly when you get into these subservices like surgery and oncology and things like that, it's very clicky.
Yeah. Right?
So you have to be able to really like do research and read into that market. And I knew enough to do that now.
Yeah.
And so I ended up passing on a lot of these things. And basically we got to the point where after about 9 months of having this business development guy really working hard, I mean, like finding a lot of opportunities and none of them really being good opportunities, I felt like the opportunity to grow this into a national management service organization wasn't there. Mm-hmm. Or if it was there, it didn't meet my own goals of speed and how quickly I wanted to grow it.
Yeah.
And so ultimately it's then, all right, do I want to let this thing keep cash flowing?
Yeah.
Or do I want to try and sell it?
And so you talked about you were running, or you kind of started Term Scout and Sondermind while you were there. What was kind of the genesis of those two ideas? How did those come about?
Yeah, so backing up even before that was Safe Image.
Yeah,
so Safe Image was like in 2010.
Yep.
We were spending not a ton of money. I mean, in the grand scheme of things, I mean, when you think about like what our revenue was and what our cost structure was, but it was wasted money on sending couriers to a referring physician's offices like neurosurgeons and medical oncologists to get the CDs of patients they're referring to us of their diagnostic scans. So like, let's say you have a brain tumor, you're going to get it scanned somewhere, you're going to go see a neurosurgeon, he's going to say, hey, I think you know you might be a candidate for CyberKnife, he's going to send all your paperwork over to us, and then our doctors are going to review it. Before he can really review it, he's going to have to say, let me see the diagnostic scan. So, you know, I'm like, well, these are all zeros and ones, why can't we transfer this? This is kind of, Dropbox was just getting started, right? Like cloud storage and all that stuff was really, I mean, you think of it now, it's like everything's in the cloud. But, you know, just go back like 6-7 years, that wasn't the case.
Yeah.
Right? Blackberries were still the thing.
Yeah, like, man.
The iPhone was brand new and all that, right?
Yeah.
So I approached my medical physicist, Steve, and I said, hey, I have this idea. Can we like create some sort of cloud-based thing that's HIPAA compliant and allows us to transfer this stuff? And he looked at me and he was like, have you been like reading my emails? Like,
oh, no way.
He's like, I've been thinking about the same thing, because he had to set up our VPNs with the imaging centers that we sent patients to.
Yeah.
And it was like a 9-month horrible process, and we get approvals from Nashville and all these other hospital organizations and stuff. And he had a friend who was a... He and Sid are both black belts, like fourth and fifth degree black belts in Taekwondo. So one of his partners and like sparring partners in Taekwondo was this really good back-end developer. And he's like, yeah, I've been kind of talking to him about it. We haven't really started anything. And so it's just really fortuitous. We sort of like, hey, let's all work on this. I mean, he knew the science side of it. He's since gotten another PhD in bioengineering with a focus on imaging informatics.
Mm-hmm.
So he's an associate professor at National Jewish now. So, you know, really, really, really smart guy on, like, the science of, like, this imaging data. It's very complex stuff.
Yeah.
Knew the clinical side of it as well. I kind of came with a little bit of business experience, and then Sid was an awesome developer. And so we created this thing just, like, nights and weekends. Truly.
Wow.
Like, you know, no outside capital at all. A little bit of our own money, but, like, over a three-year period, we put in a total of, like, $15,000 or something.
Oh, no way.
Like, got it to about $1,000 a month of free cash flow.
Yeah.
Took like no time. I mean,
yeah.
Like, I mean, not took no time to build it.
Yeah.
But once we got it going,
yeah.
It didn't take any time to manage it.
Yeah.
And talked to a lot of people about potentially buying us.
Yeah.
Viterra came pretty close. Viterra is a really big EMR company, private equity owned. You know, they were sold for like $6 billion or something like that. And then it fell apart because they bought two other companies that did something totally different. They basically consolidated two other medical records companies.
Oh, man.
And ultimately just kept it running and thought about maybe raising money, but were like, didn't think the market was really there. And
yeah.
From a, just didn't line up personally with like, I had this other stuff going, Sid had some stuff going. Steve was in this PhD program that was sponsored and paid for by National Jewish. And
yeah.
He didn't want to give up that.
Yeah.
And ended up selling that in February of this year, 2016,
okay.
To a company called Zenbelt Medical, which is a personal health record company.
Congrats.
Primarily like an equity sale. We got a little bit of cash.
Yeah.
But we kind of view it as just like, hey, it's another angel investment.
Yeah.
You know,
that's incredible. Two acquisitions under your belt already.
Yeah. And one was like healthcare services as pure services as you can get. And one was like as pure healthcare technology as you can get, right? It was like SaaS selling to doctor's offices, you know, had a patient application that was free and freemium kind of thing.
Yeah.
And had some unique technology components too also.
Mm.
So 2013... This was before we had sold Safe Image, but after we decided we weren't really going to like focus on it.
Yeah.
And also at the time where I was like pretty sure Next Oncology was not going to grow into something bigger, and that we were still in the, like the shaking tree standpoint.
Yeah.
The writing was on the wall in my opinion a little bit.
Yeah.
So I was in my mind I was a little bit on the beach, right?
Yeah.
I was like not exactly because I was still a paycheck and cash flow coming from this other business, and I mean it still took some of my time.
Mm-hmm.
So was actually interested in, so my the story behind Sondermine is my younger sister is a psychologist,
mm-hmm.
and she set up her own private practice after going, you know, getting her master's and working at an agency for 3 or 4 years. And in like 2008, 2009, she started her private practice, and I remember seeing all the like business 101 stuff she had to go through. And talking to her about that, and there were a lot of it was start up your business, and there's challenges there. And as a single provider, there's even more challenges. Some of it was specific to behavioral health, and I won't get into all that. But I had this nugget of an idea, but I was focused on Denver Cybernetics at that point.
Yeah.
So fast forward now, I was at like a co-working space here in Denver.
Mm-hmm.
And as I mentioned, I had a real estate license and had bought a couple of properties and was like, oh, I've got some cash flow. I'd like to invest in commercial real estate, but I don't want to be a landlord. That's not really my thing.
Yeah.
I'd rather like build a business that has a real estate component to it or is like tied to me owning real estate in conjunction with having an operating business, right?
Yeah.
It's kind of like the franchisee model, right?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, open a business and buy the real estate for it, and the real money is in the real estate long term, right?
Mm-hmm.
So... co-working is interesting. You know, you see Galvanize do really well. We work, this is before they were gone, being really Regis and all that. But I like the business model, but I think it's super tied to economic cycles. And it'll be interesting to see how it all plays out over the next 5 or 10 years.
Yeah.
For me, I felt like the risk was too great to start that and not have a good other plan with like how you're going to fill that space.
Yeah.
And the TI is totally different than if you were like put companies in there. So I thought, well, who's the set of like consumers or tenants that would really benefit from co-working space and can't go into a Starbucks like a Galvanize, you know, or a WeWork developer can when they're like a contractor? They can go in anywhere, right? They can just like work from home, or they can go work at Starbucks and meet people or something like that. Same time, my sister is now transitioning from having a full-time private practice to she's got her second kid on the way. She only wants to see clients on Tuesday evenings and Thursday mornings.
Yeah.
She's dealing with subletting. Well, she's not going to see clients in her house.
Yeah.
She can't do it in a Starbucks or something like that or a regular co-working space. Yeah, that's
such a great idea.
You know? Yeah. So I'm like, oh, there's a model here.
Yeah.
At the same time, my wife and I, we've gone through therapy.
Yeah.
We should be going to therapy more. Like
yeah,
we
yeah.
All, I think I need to go to more.
I'm a huge personally. Advocate as well. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, yep. I've always thought that the experience around the therapy, not the therapy itself,
yeah,
but like the finding the right therapist and engaging with them and calling them and nobody answers the phone and then
yeah.
not taking new clients and they don't take your insurance
yeah.
and blah, blah, blah. You know what rates they charge, all this other stuff. And then on the backside, like rescheduling appointments and even just showing up and it's in like the basement office and it's sort of closed and there's no windows and it's sort of depressing
yeah.
and you're not really feeling that good anyway. Why is that such a bad experience?
Yeah, you're like, we can free up the professional to focus on what they do well.
Exactly.
And we can provide, I'm imagining, all the back office
all
support,
back office
scheduling,
stuff,
payments,
and a
front end
piece where it's like,
yeah.
let's build a brand around this. Like,
yeah.
you know, look at like Massage Envy.
Yeah.
It's like, why isn't there a Massage Envy for behavioral health?
Yeah.
Right? Why isn't there like a Core Power Yoga for behavioral health?
Yeah.
Why isn't there an Uber for behavioral health? Like,
yeah.
why isn't there somebody
yeah.
who's like, put a brand around this and it makes it like really accessible?
Yeah.
Not for the super high need. At the end of the day, I don't want to be crass, but the couple in criminal class that is like having marriage issues because they're daughter in whatever private high school or something like that is like struggling and didn't make the soccer team.
Yeah.
They don't want to be sitting next to the homeless crystal meth addict.
Yeah.
Right? Let's just be blunt about
yeah.
it. Right? Like they're just if they go to that environment, they're like, this isn't for me. I'm out of here.
Yeah.
Right? They want a high end experience. They
yeah.
want kind of this thing that's like repeatable and they know what they're getting and it's airy and it's got it uses technology and all this other stuff. So I felt like there was this opportunity between this need on the provider side that I saw firsthand with my sister,
yeah,
and this need on the consumer side, which I saw firsthand personally,
yeah,
and this opportunity in a growing market and an acceptance of behavioral health that is just continuing to grow over time.
Hmm.
And so started thinking about that. Besides my sister, my cousin's a psychologist in Florida in private practice. Her husband's a psychiatrist.
Yeah.
So I had enough people to do a lot of user interview testing and things like that.
Yeah.
And was looking for you know, doing competitor analysis and stuff like that around the country.
Yeah.
Couldn't really find anybody.
Yeah,
with this
I can't
kind
think
of
anyone doing this. Yeah.
And found, lo and behold, here in Denver, this guy who was a therapist himself had started a practice, had grown kind of his practice and opened up some additional office space. And instead of just subletting it, it created more of like a community membership type model, which was like using the space more of
yeah.
like a co-working kind of model.
Yeah.
And I reached out to him and said, hey, you're doing a lot of some of the stuff that I want to do. I know I need a clinical partner who understands the psychology side of it, the clinical side of it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to part with my sister. She's across the country and family and all this other stuff.
Yeah.
And that's how I met Sean. And we started kind of dating in like the spring of 2013, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I say we like got married in like 2014 and,
yeah.
and, you know, basically took what he had started with Unique Counseling and formed that into Sondermind. And you know, really created the new company in spring of 2014.
Yeah, man.
So that was that. At the same time, you know, like if that wasn't a full time thing during that kind of dating process, I got matched up with this guy through common connections who was on the commercial real estate side. He had this really interesting data play regarding pulling in data sources, kind of filtering a lot of the information and then sending out lead gen to commercial real estate agents on the tenant rep side, which is what he had done.
Yeah.
He had been really successful in doing this personally and was looking to do this in more of like a true data sense.
Yeah.
He, myself, a data scientist and another developer of the CTO kind of came together under his, Chris was the one pulling it all together. He was like the primary founder and the three of us were sort of co-founders.
Mm.
And started working on that in like the fall of 2013 and then really like kind of formed everything in 2013, 2014 timeframe. And so I had these two things going. Term Scout started taking off a little bit faster.
Mm-hmm.
I helped raise money. We raised a seed round in the late spring of 2014. At the same time, we were rebranding everything to Sondermind in 2014 with Sean. Sean was the best guy to really hold the reins for that first year or so.
Yeah.
I was still very involved from kind of summer 2014 and summer 2015 with Sondermind, but I was, you know, full time with Term Scout, and we raised some capital and got that going. And ultimately, you know, I felt like I needed to focus on Sondermind. There were some differences of opinion on where to take Term Scout as well, and so it was just the right time to sort of in the summer of 2015 to say, all right, I'm going to leave. That was also when I was exiting Next Oncology.
Yeah.
And so, all right, let me leave. You know, we did like a 3-month transition. And then I, you know, jumped in and kind of Sean handed the reins over to me. And I took over in September 2015 for Sondermind.
That's pretty rad.
Yeah.
What advice, you know, given your just diverse experience in startups, what advice do you have for a veteran who's thinking of starting their own company?
So there's a lot, right? I talk to a lot of veterans who are starting companies because I'm involved with Patriot Bootcamp. I've been involved with The Bunker at some of the chapters, and just my network.
You know,
I mean, I get a lot of inbounds from veteran entrepreneurs. I was just talking to one last week, and, you know, he had these thoughts about raising money, and I was like, you know, where are you at? And he's like, well, I've got this, you know, we've like built this MVP, and I'm like, oh, just describe it to me. And the MVP was really like just business model proof of concept. They hadn't built anything yet, like not even MVP on the software. And he wanted to raise $750,000, and I was like, hey, you gotta like, I mean, the bar has been raised over the last 3 years, right? And you're gonna have to have a product, a functional product. It's still the MVP, but you have a functional software product that's bringing in revenue before you even think about raising any money, right?
Yeah.
So my main piece of advice for veteran entrepreneurs is work on the idea on the side as much as you can, right? Like build that up, get something where it's just punching you in the face that you have to quit whatever your full-time job is and do this other thing. And don't do that until you've got, I mean, if you need to raise money in order to do that, start raising money, or start talking to investors, even if you're not like actually going to take the check, start talking to investors, because they'll give you really candid, most of them will give you pretty candid feedback on, you need to hit this milestone, you need to have this many customers, you need to have this amount of revenue before I even think about writing you a check. And unless you have the bankroll to float you yourself for 6 to 9 months, if you think you're going to raise money in, you know, 2 or 3 months, you're not, right? Unless you have 2 or 3 exits under your belt. And even then, like, it's really, really, really hard to raise money.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I feel like, ideally you could meet with a VC 6 months before you want to raise money to know what you need to drive towards and what those metrics are.
Yeah.
And I love that thought of, not putting pressure on your creativity by expecting your startup to pay your bills from day one.
Right.
And so many of the entrepreneurs I speak with, they've worked on their idea on the side for sometimes years before they're able to make that shift over. So I think that's really sound advice.
Yeah.
Are there any resources you would point listeners to if they're interested in entrepreneurship? It could be websites, podcasts, programs. Just where do you find your inspiration?
I'm more of a, you know, talk to people kind of person.
Yeah.
So I'll plug, you know, Patriot Bootcamp, I think, is a really good resource. Just check it out. You know, they have, even if you don't go to one of the Patriot Bootcamps because you're not there yet or not selected, everybody involved is pretty open. So even just from a networking standpoint, just talk to people, right? Mm-hmm. I'd say use LinkedIn. I mean, I remember talking to a couple of people they were like, oh, I don't really have a LinkedIn account. I was like, what? Like, okay, create a LinkedIn account and start, you know, reaching out to people, and don't just offer to, don't just like try and connect.
Yeah.
But, you know, find somebody who's connected to you. Start locally, right? There are enough resources locally.
Yeah.
I don't have any one particular website. I mean, I would say also get out of the veteran thing.
Yeah.
Right? Like, follow some blogs.
Yeah.
Right? Get on Fred Wilson's blog and like sign up for Mattermark's email newsletter.
Yeah.
I was telling somebody that last week. I said, are you getting Mattermark? And he was like, I've heard of it, but I'm just sign up for the free newsletter. It's a daily and then a weekly summary. I read that. I mean, I skim through it. There's almost always at least one or two headline links that pertain to me.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Click on it, read it, save it in a pocket, whatever. Right. But start getting an understanding of, what is the environment like?
Yeah.
Like, not just from veterans, but if you want to be an entrepreneur, if you want to start a company, start reading about starting companies, start talking to people, start, you know, understanding from the investor side, from the customer side, from the marketing side, all these different pieces, what it takes and getting, you know, an understanding of it. I got a really good piece of advice when I first started business school. I was interested in private equity, and I was like, oh, this seems like a, you know, really interesting industry. And one of my really good friends now, he was like, look, you're probably not going to get a job coming out of business school at a private equity firm. Mm. And I thought he was being a dick, but he was like, look, I'm not trying to be a dick, but here's the truth. All these undergrads who went to UPenn and Harvard and Yale and University of Chicago or whatever, they went as an analyst into Morgan Stanley or Goldman Sachs or Credit Suisse or whatever, right? They did a two-year program. After that two-year program, they went out and they worked as an associate. It's called, you know, associate in private equity is like an analyst in banking. So the lowest rung on the totem pole at KKR, at Bain Capital, at, you know, whatever, name your favorite private equity firm. They did that for 2 years, sometimes three. And then they got pushed out. I mean, in each case, they're like, you can't stay here. You got to go.
Yeah.
Right? Go to business school. Then they're fighting. Half of them are fighting to get back in.
Yeah.
And they're only, it's a pyramid structure, right? Yeah. So they're only taking, you know, 50% or 30% of those people who came out.
Yeah.
So you're competing as people who have not just, like, not just are in the same business school, you have done the job that needs to be done.
Yeah.
They know exactly what to do.
Yeah.
What's an employer going to do, right? Mm-hmm. Like, hire the guy who was in the Army for 5 years? Or hire the guy who did banking and then private equity for 3 years to go do private equity?
Yeah.
Right? So the advice was, if you really want to do this, sign up for, you know, they gave me like a couple of newsletters. Like, sign up for these two or three newsletters and just start reading about it.
Yeah.
Become more knowledgeable about this industry and about what's going on. And the not just like how it works, but the topical things.
Yeah.
Hey, I saw this deal happen that day. What do you think about that multiple?
Yeah.
Right? Start becoming more knowledgeable about it than the other guy. That's your only chance.
Yeah.
Right? I would have the same advice for any veterans in any industry you want to go to. Start learning the industry.
Yeah.
Right? Start like getting educated on it. And it's not something you can just like read a book, right? It's going to take some time to like really get a feel for how things are going and start to see patterns over a longer period of time.
I love it. Well, for listeners, I'll throw in show notes for links to the links to everything you mentioned there, because there's a lot of great resources. I know we're at the tail end of our time, so I always like to leave the last question just to be open-ended, which was, you know, we've covered a lot about startups and finance and all these great things, but what else would you want to share with listeners? It could be personal or professional, but knowing that you have veterans in active duty, what else would you want to say to them?
Well, I'd say two things. So one is, be proud of what you've done in the military. I mean, it's, I was surprised, and I didn't see it as much in banking, but that's just because it's like a tight knit group of people and you're not interfacing that much. In this entrepreneurial world, I get a lot of pats on the back, right? Like, thank you for your service.
Yeah.
And I used to sort of be like, no big deal sort of thing. And I've changed it to sort of now my traditional response, and it's always on Veterans Day, like,
you
know, all the time, right?
Yeah.
But I'm just like, it was an honor to serve, right? And it really was, right? Like, I look back at my time in the military as really valuable from a personal growth standpoint, but also in the trust that, you know, the country or the organization puts in you to say like, hey, 22-year-old second lieutenant, like, here's 30 soldiers that you now are in charge of. And like, all of them are way more experienced than you, but you make the decision.
Yeah.
And I'm like, what an honor to be given that opportunity.
Yeah.
Right. And so be proud of that. Don't shy away from it. The flip side of that is, I see this all the time. Don't expect that anybody is going to give any credit to anything you've done in the military. Right. If you, whether you're an NCO, whether you're an officer, just imagine that an average employer, investor, partner, customer, whomever, is going to see that, if they didn't come from the military, they're going to see that period of time that you were in the military, generally speaking, as being like blank space.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, I don't really know. It's just, it's dark matter to them. They have no idea what happened then. So they're not going to see that, hey, you ran an organization, right? You led this, you know, this company is the number two guy in command through a deployment and, you know, safely returned everybody and tens of millions of dollars pieces of equipment back to this, you know, all the stuff that you did, right?
Yeah.
Ran logistics for the brigade or whatever. That's all white noise to them.
Yeah.
They're just going to go, okay, Army, you have no skill set, right? Or if you came out of business school, you basically have like, I don't really know, you're just like, you might as well be an absolute career changer, right? Like, you did marketing and now you want to do finance. Like, totally two different things, right?
Yeah.
They're not going to give any credence to what you did. Now, you can find pockets in a minute. I'd say, if your goal is to really leverage your experience, then find veterans who are in hiring positions because they'll understand it.
Yeah.
But you know, don't think that you're going to get, you'll get a pat on the back and a thank you, but you won't get a job offer mm-hmm. for being a veteran.
Yeah,
for the most part.
I think that's great on both counts, and I love that it's an honor to serve, because I similarly feel uncomfortable when someone says that because I don't know what to say in response.
I know.
And I think my mind goes to either the people that are still in, mm-hmm. or
that's right.
Yeah, or the people who were in much more intense circumstances
exactly,
than
yeah.
I were. And so I'm like, thank them, don't thank me type of thing. But I like that because it was an honor to serve, and it was, you know, it was something that not a lot of people did. And I like the flip side of that too, which is like, don't expect things to be handed to you. And I think that approaching it as white space, there's no downside.
Right.
If you approach this as like, hey, no one's going to give me credit for that, you're going to have to work harder. And so there's no risk in approaching a career search like that.
Right.
Yeah. Well, thank you for your time on all this and all the value. And
my
I
pleasure.
Know this will be helpful for listeners.
Awesome.
Surface.
Thanks for listening. As we wrap up, I wanted to share three quick but important announcements. First of all, if you haven't already, please sign up for my newsletter at beyondtheuniform.io. Although I publish on LinkedIn and Facebook, I'll be starting to use the newsletter as my primary means to share new articles, episodes, and resources relevant to the veteran community. Second, I would love to hear from you. Sometimes I feel like I'm in a relationship where I do all of the talking. You can view me as your very own dedicated resource to help you and other veterans in your civilian career. Have feedback on what I can do differently? Let me know. Someone in particular you want me to track down for an interview? I'm all ears. Know of another way that I could help the veteran community? I'm dying to know. You can find me on LinkedIn, comment on any post at beyondtheuniform.io, email me at justin@beyondtheuniform.io, or if you're in the intel industry, I'm sure you can track me down in some super creepy way. However you do it, take me up on it. I thrive on feedback. Lastly, a quick plug for a few resources I think would benefit any veteran. American Corporate Partners and Service to School both provide free assistance to any veteran. American Corporate Partners pairs you with a mentor in your desired industry, and Service to Schools finds a mentor at a suitable undergrad or graduate school program to help you with your application. Check them out. As always, tons of great content and resources available at beyondtheuniform.io. I'm Justin Nasiri, and I'll be back soon with more great episodes.